Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. 108 Contemporary, formerly known as the Brady Craft Alliance, is currently hosting their first artist-in-residence in their new gallery space at 108 East Brady. Oklahoma fiber artist Heather Clark Hilliard is that artist, and for her exhibition, she's divided the gallery space into an exhibit of existing work, as well as creating a new original artwork specific to the gallery space. The exhibit is titled Finding the Fire, Concepts in Fiber Arts. And she actually begins work on that installation today. Hilliard focuses on creating natural colors in fabric, fiber, paper, and exhibiting her handmade constructions. She studied natural dyeing techniques with master dyers, even has her own natural dye garden in her home. Through the processes of spinning, knitting, stitching, and felting, Hilliard creates works that explore subtle gradations of natural and botanical dyes. Her work has been previously displayed in New Mexico, Texas, and Minnesota, as well as Oklahoma. The exhibit opened on July 5th and will close on July 20th, and Hilliard will be giving an artist talk a week from this Friday on the 19th at 6 o'clock, which will discuss her creative process as well as the new work she's created at 108 Contemporary. Heather Clark Hilliard is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Heather Hilliard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
You are 108 Contemporary's inaugural artist in residence, and it's a beautiful space. And does that affect you in the site-specific installation you're creating?
When I first saw the gallery, I just fell in love with the space immediately. It's new, it's very contemporary, it's very clean, and I wanted to do a project that utilized that space. They have high ceilings, large windows,
literally a park across the street.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful location, a combination of everything going on in that downtown Brady Arts District. So I was really excited in designing the exhibition itself and then designing a project to make in the gallery and using that space.
Is that something you do often where you'll do a site-specific installation, or is this a new thing for you?
It's something I've been working more and more with the last year or 2 years, and I'm very interested in pursuing that and continuing on. I like the temporariness of it and that effort and the work that goes into getting it up, and it stays like that, and then it comes down. And the next time, you may be installing the same project, but it's always going to be different. I have another piece in the exhibit called Bloodlines, Love Lines, which is an installation made with hand-spun yarn that's dyed with a natural dye called Matter Root. And this is the second time that I've installed that installation, and it's in a completely different space, so the piece changes, and this time you can walk under it, and you can see it from different angles, and so it's nice to see that evolution in the site-specific.
So obviously, it's a three-dimensional sculptural piece.
Yes, it is.
And was that created on site?
Was done on site during the week of the installing the exhibit.
Interesting. And how did the piece change from one environment to another? Because I'm interested in how much an environment can affect an artwork.
It can affect it a lot. And a lot of it is the light. It's the orientation of the wall. It's specifically this yarn installation that I did is, you know, around the corner. It's in a corner where there's a doorway. So that changes it, you know, when it becomes a utility, you know, a function area. How do you
an adornment
go
in many ways
around
yeah.
that? How do you put that into the installation? So the environment changes, and that's what's great about the site-specific installations. It's always really helpful to see it ahead of time, so you have an idea of the ceiling height and what the floors are like and what the light is like.
Well, before we talk about the exhibit and the installation you're creating for 108 mm-hmm. Contemporary, let's talk a little bit about you. Now, how did you get into fiber art? I know some people come through it from traditional arts and crafts, others from it, say, a fine art, moving from, you know, sculpture or painting or you know, one of the other or crafts and come to it that way. Some come from the clothing angle. How did you come to it?
I have a background in photography.
Okay, well, that's a new one.
Which seems like a big leap to go from photography into fibers. But about 20 years ago, I had a friend whose mother was a hand spinner and a weaver. and a natural dyer. In a more traditional sense, she wove blankets, she spun her own yarn. And when I saw her dye porch, her screened-in dye porch that was off of her studio, and this is in Connecticut, and she raised her own sheep, and she showed me a dye bath that she was doing that's made out of the bark of a heartwood. It's called Brazil wood, and it makes the most gorgeous fuchsia pink color. And when I saw that, I was off and running. That was the end of that. I just wanted to
Now, she was doing it for
the
traditional craft element,
right?
I mean, so this is like, you know, utilitarian functions. Mm-hmm. But she was taking it to the nth degree because you're raising your own sheep. My goodness.
And I love the idea of that. But my heart is in bringing it into the contemporary conversation. And so I like to utilize these traditional techniques like hand spinning and natural dyeing. I think that they have a place, and they are infinitely interesting. I mean, each plant has its own history, each plant has its own geography, each plant has its own chemistry, and, you know, so there's a wealth of information and knowledge just in that process itself.
Now, people are saying you're talking about plants, and we were just talking about sheep. How does it, and the plants are the dyes.
Right, the plants are the
dyes. And so you're
using
natural dyes.
I'm using natural dyes. Sorry for the confusion. Yes, so the sheep, I'm spinning the wool and then dyeing the wool with plant dyes. And this is a process that has a very long history in terms of, mm-hmm. of human history.
As long as we've been wearing clothes.
And so it's a beautiful process. But I really wanted to bring it into a contemporary conversation. So I like kind of doing that labor, doing that research, learning about it. And it gives me a connection to the materials that I'm working with. But what I do with those materials becomes a contemporary
Yes, very much, very much contemporary. Yeah.
Not the traditional, this is what's made out of.
Did you start out with the traditional, I mean, sort of the craft side of this form?
I am a hand knitter also. Mm-hmm. I'm actually a fourth generation knitter on the maternal side of my family. But I think I'm the only one in my family who can't follow a knitting pattern to save my life. So when I learned how to knit, and I grasp the basics of it, but I think of knitting a lot like architecture. There is a building, there's a foundation. Once you understand what has to happen, then you can take knitting into any direction. And I have a couple pieces in the exhibit, Finding the Fire, that 108 Contemporary, that are knitted, hand-spun, naturally dyed yarn.
Tell us a little about them. What are they exactly?
They're part of a series of work that's called Lines of Language, Language of Lines. And it's an exploration of how we communicate. And it started by thinking about, you know, when we write, all the letters that we write are formed with lines. And knitting really is the same way. It is building one line upon another line that's going in this direction or that direction. So it becomes, you know, each stitch becomes a word. You know, each row of stitching becomes a sentence. You know, so it's communicating in a visual sense than in our reading sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to hand spinning, how difficult was this to learn, pick up this craft? Was it pretty easy? Did it come naturally?
Now, I am by no means a master hand spinner. I have seen some beautiful technical hand spinning. I really love the movement of it and that connection, the symbolism and just a piece of yarn, you know, and how we spin yarns, you know, and tell stories. So there's a lot of symbolism in that.
Now, as far as materials, having made your own yarn as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, purchasing mm-hmm. yarn and using it, does that make a big difference to you?
For me, it does. And I do it and I still do it because I like that connection. I can't buy the kind of yarn that I want to use. And there's life in it to me. When I'm using something that is so commercially processed, there's something that gets removed from that. And so I'm not as inspired by the materials. So that's why I continue to do these processes, to stay connected to what I'm using and why I'm using it.
Now, some of your yarns have to be pretty heavy duty because they're holding a lot of weight. Some of them.
It depends. I mean, you can spin yarn out of dozens of varieties of fiber. There are, you know, there are just dozens of species of sheep. So in each, you know, I mean, so it can be endless
right.
and endless experimentation. Some of my pieces are quite large, but they're large, but they're lightweight.
My guest today is Heather Clark Hilliard, who is 108 Contemporary's first artist in residence. She's a fiber artist. A new exhibit is titled Finding the Fire, Concepts in Fiber Art, which includes some pre-done work as well as a site-specific installation, which is on display through July 20th at 108 Contemporary. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, tell me a little bit about your dye garden, because you actually grow the plants that make the natural dyes for Brazil wood may be a hard one.
Yeah.
That sounds a little tropical to me.
I do purchase a lot of the natural dyes I use. The dye garden that I have is more of an observational dye garden.
It's
to become familiar with the plants, get an idea of their growing habits. It's like, you know, growing all your tomatoes that you're going to consume for the year. That's a big job. So growing all of the dye plants that I use, I don't do that.
No, of course not.
But I do have some mainstays in my dye garden because I like to save the seed. They're not commercially available, or if they are, they're really difficult to find. And those are things like Japanese indigo, which is Indigofera tinctoria.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, when I think of indigo, I think of that's like a water plant, isn't it? Or is it, I think of it like a rice, traditional indigo.
It's a legume, actually.
Okay.
And there are about 200 different plants throughout the world that have that indican in them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are three plants that are very, very strong, and that's the Japanese indigo, and then there's the tropical indigo, which is Indigofera tinctoria. The Japanese indigo is Polygonum tinctorium. And then there's woad, which is Isatis tinctoria.
Mm. And what color does this make?
Japanese? So this is the blue.
This is the blue color.
So it's a beautiful plant. The leaves are beautiful. It makes tall, spiky flowers with pink or white flowers on them. And I grow that plant. It actually likes it in Oklahoma if it can have some water, but it likes the humidity and the heat. But I grow it to save the seed.
Mm-hmm.
And same with the madder plant, which is Rubia tinctoria. And the madder plant has a jewel in, you know, it's the root of the plant. So the plant doesn't look like much above ground. It's underground where the roots are red and it makes the most spectacular red dye.
Other things in the garden that you use?
Coreopsis tinctoria, which is a native wildflower here in Oklahoma. You know, beautiful, sweet little flower that makes a nice kind of apricot orange color. Goldenrod, which makes a yellow. It's a good yellow that we have here. And then there's a whole range of plants that make yellow dyes.
So and that's really interesting because it's maybe part of the plant itself or the flower maybe. Other times it's the root.
It changes, right. Or it could be the like black walnuts. It could be the walnut hulls.
Uh-huh.
It could be the leaves. It could be the bark. It could be the flowers. It could be the whole plant, you know, from the ground up or the whole plant, you know, from below the ground. So each plant, as I said earlier, each plant has its own chemistry. It has its own what it needs to where you're extracting the color.
I wonder
from.
If the dyes are affected by the geography of where the plants grow.
Yes. So it's the same thing as our food crops. It is, you know, the years that apples are really great. There are years that berries are really great. So the dye plants are the same thing. It depends on the soil they're growing in. It depends on the conditions they're growing. I mean, that same variety applies.
Say we've been through you're a native of Norman, and we've had 2 years of drought, maybe going on 3 years around Norman. Has that affected the colors of your dyes that come out of your garden?
Because I'm purchasing a lot of my dye, I either purchase whole materials or I'm purchasing natural dye extracts, or I may be using, you know, marigolds or coreopsis that come from my garden. It depends on the project. It depends on, you know, where there's an abundance of plants. Another series of work that I've been working on for the last 4 years is collected color. And it is, I prepare the material ahead of time, and then each summer my husband and I go on a domestic adventure across the country, and we carry about 40 quart-sized mason jars on the roof of our car, and I collect dye plants. I identify them when we're on the road, and I collect them, and I pack them into the jars with the material.
And so we're talking about roadside stops and go get a cutting?
driving 60 miles, you know, an hour
stop
down
the
highway. Wait, can you turn around? You know, my husband's a really good sport about it. But it's turned into a really interesting project to see how the plants that I can collect change as the geography changes. So what, you know, may grow in New Mexico doesn't grow in Oklahoma, but I travel with a small library of dye books so I can identify plants correctly and see if, you know, does this have any history in the dye plant, you know, world at all.
Wow, that sounds very didactic. But I assume you can see subtle differences and say, well, maybe I want to, you know, use the dye from a natural plant from this region.
Yes. I mean, some of them are much more subtle than others, but it's the whole project has evolved into a documentation. There are several of these collected color pieces in the exhibit at 108. And they have a beautiful range of colors, but there is a subtlety to all of them, mostly just in the way that I'm putting the project together.
And the gradients. So you're getting a little color gradient thing.
Right, right.
Going on. Well, my guest today is Heather Clark Hilliard, who is the inaugural artist in residence for 108 Contemporary, and she'll be creating an on-site installation. Tell us a little about this piece.
This project I designed specifically for the gallery space. I had to prepare some of the material ahead of time because I didn't think it'd be such a great space to be doing an indigo bath in.
That sounds kind of messy.
Right, or chopping wood. So I did that material preparation ahead of time. The project itself is called Memory Ring, and I wanted to use a material that came from Oklahoma, but was not specifically about Oklahoma. So I'm using the Juniperus virginiana, which is the juniper tree, the western red cedar, and it's harvested from my acres out in East Norman. I had to cut them down about 2 or 3 years ago because of the drought and the fire hazard. They're too close to a house. So I've had those tree trunks curing for the last couple years. And so I have sliced them all like a loaf of bread, you know, slicing so that you end up with small discs. And I have dyed those blue using indigo and tannins and iron, and have drilled small holes in each of those pieces. So I have about 750 pieces total, and I will be stitching those together and creating a sculpture in the gallery which hangs from the ceiling.
That sounds really cool. And, of course, that's the piece I have seen of yours, which is Can You Hear Me Now, is, again, this sort of melding of fiber art and other materials. Mm-hmm. In the case of that piece, it's a PVC pipe.
Right. I have been working.
It's interesting. We've talked a lot about natural materials and natural processes, but, you know, PVC pipe works. PVC pipe works.
Right. Then there's these industrial materials that have been showing up in my work the last couple of years. And this actually started from a project a couple of years ago that I did with my rabbit cages. I used to raise rabbits. And I don't have the rabbits anymore. So there's these materials from a time in my life that I'm not living now. But I wanted to transform those materials. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of redeeming that history or recognizing it and transforming it into something else, which plays into our, you know, memories of our lives and how our lives change and turn into something else. So I started wrapping these cages with yarn. And there's a piece in the exhibit called Anatomy that is an extension of that idea. So that's where these industrial-made materials started coming in, the wire, the PVC pipe. I told you I lived out in the country. And this is before cell phones were really good. So I literally would walk around in the woods saying, can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Like the commercial, you know, and it so I had a temporary phone line, landline, and I had to put in the PVC conduit. So that was, you know, it's this extension of using these materials that have a personal history to me, and that's where my connection to those come in. But they are very industrial, they're very kind of brutal, and, you know, they're not soft and fuzzy like hand-spun yarn, but I like that contrast.
But the whole thing is, what was amazing to me is, like looking at pictures of Can You Hear Me Now at a distance, it looks like a fiber piece. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is woven. Mm-hmm. But when you get up, you go, oh my gosh, that's little PVC pipes. That's obviously some sort of wiring along with yarn in there. And it's the way it looks is great. And the whole thing with the Can You Hear Me Now, there's these through lines. And I guess maybe because I'm in radio, we work with digital equipment all the time, so we're seeing voice tracks. It looks like there's a voice track in it. It looks like there are digital wave lines denoting sound. Was that intentional or was that just, it worked out?
For me, it's interesting to hear you say that. And that's what's so great about viewing art and talking to people about art is what they see and then what the artists saw while they were making it. So for me, it was actually more about the geography, the land lines.
I could see an imagined landscape in this mm-hmm. piece. Yeah, there's a little mountainous figure in the middle, and I assume that could be a landscape.
Right, so there's a lot of geography, and that's sort of this tie in between all of my work is this ecology, geography, the mapping, the connection to the landscape, the plants. So that Can You Hear Me Now is crocheted. Mm-hmm. That's how it's assembled. And it has three different natural dyes in it, the madder, marigolds, and indigo. And the PVC conduit is hand cut, with the PVC cutter. It's very meticulous time. When I finished, I had about 313 feet of that. So then it became a matter of assembling the
and those
project.
Are what? How small are they?
They're about about a half inch.
That's a lot of cuts.
That's a lot of cuts. Yes.
A lot of times when you're working with artists who are working with materials like that, there's a sense of it's obsession in many senses because you're just doing the same thing over and over and over to create your materials to work with. I'm really fascinated by that.
There's a lot of repetition in the work that I do. There's a lot of repetition in traditional processes, in methodologies in those processes. But I enjoy that repetition. Now, sometimes it takes a while to kind of get my brain in that space, but that's part of it because once you're in that sort of meditation mode, other ideas, other things can happen and can come to you. And then for me, in that process of working, then it comes about following the work. And, every decision that I make now when I make something is coming from learning all these other processes and this hand memory of working that can just happen. And it's letting that happen.
To me, that's the whole thing is you would see this, and for somebody, normal people who would be trying to do something like this, it would be about, I have to think of this well before I start, of what this piece is going to look like, or. And I assume after doing this process over and over again, you're making the decision as you create, which is like just any sort of like a painter, like a sculptor or what?
I think artists work in different ways. And I do know some artists that really plan out what they're doing. And I am not one of those artists. I have a reaction with materials and I have a vision in my head. And I might sketch a little bit and then I try to problem solve and things like that. I have started many projects that I have gotten into and then said, oh, wait, how am I going to hang this? But I work that way. I've always worked that way. And I just have to just continue that as part of my process. But part of it is more of a collaboration with the materials that I'm working with. I don't like to work against materials. And I can't force a project. So I have an idea when I start of where I'm going, but I have to allow that to change. Otherwise, it becomes really rigid, and then that becomes uninteresting.
Yeah, but I could see, with say, a more visceral art form, to start over if something's not working is mm-hmm. a pretty easy process. Mm-hmm. Paint over, mm-hmm. Throw the print away. But with the craft techniques, there's so much labor involved in getting to the point where you're actually creating. I think it would be tough to walk away from something that's not working or figuring out a way to salvage it.
Or to keep going. There's another piece in the exhibit called Fault Lines that's made out of a piece of industrial wool. And I hand-stitch copper wire into the industrial wool. And that was a very trying project, not only the difficulty of stitching copper wire, but it became so labor intensive. But I got so far into the project, I had to see it through. But that became then an issue of discipline. There is a lot of discipline in getting a piece of art made.
Now, when you have something that's not going well, I mean, that sounds like it was not going well just because of the labor involved and just the difficulty of working with this heavy wool product.
Sitting down for a number of hours and focusing on that. But that's earlier when I said kind of getting my brain into that mode. That piece actually took me about a year to get into.
Wow.
So there can be and I have other pieces where there's an even longer incubation time. Like I might do samples with materials, or I know I want to combine these two materials. But sometimes it just, you know, it's an incubation. And then it's the physically doing it is a whole other thing.
Now, is something, if you're talking about putting two materials like that together, is this something you try before you actually say, okay, I'm going to create a piece?
I'll do, for something like the industrial wool, I had to make sure I could actually get a sewing needle through it, you know, that I could thread the copper wire on the needle, kind of practical things like that.
Yeah, no.
But once I figure that out or make adjustments for that, then the project can really start to come to life.
My guest today is Heather Clark Hilliard, the inaugural artist in residence for 108 Contemporary. She'll be in Tulsa creating a site-specific art installation all this week. She'll be having a gallery talk on the July 19th, mm-hmm. and then the exhibit closes on the 20th, and it features a variety of already completed work as well as the site-specific installation. Now, very, very quickly, you said this is going to be a ceiling work. Will it be two-dimensional, three-dimensional? Because you mentioned this last site-specific work that you created that is three-dimensional in this particular space.
This will be three-dimensional. There's a steel 4-foot ring armature that is already hanging in the gallery. Mm-hmm. That's what the piece will
hang off
be
of.
Suspended uh-huh. from. So it will be assembling the components of the piece and forming that sculpture.
Now, have you ever worked with this material before, the little cedars?
No, this is a new material for me. I've worked with wood before, you know, so it's not totally foreign to me, but I've never stitched it. I've never sliced them up and stitched them together. But the other reason I wanted to use the junipers is they are Oklahoma's only native evergreen tree, but they are also an invasive species.
Yeah, they're called a weed.
And so there is this, you know, I think of invasive plant species as these plants that came
from outside,
from someplace else. But this is one that actually is native here. And so it becomes a dialogue about why it is invasive, and there is no more natural fire on the prairie anymore.
And it's fire is something we fear now.
Incredibly opportunistic, and given all the fires that have happened recently in Colorado and Arizona.
Or here.
And here because of our drought conditions. But ironically, because of our drought conditions, the juniper tree, because it is native, is one of the trees that can survive here. So there is this, you know, this conflict or this contrast in just this one species of trees. And people don't like the juniper tree. I've seen some pretty intimidating looking equipment to remove them.
Yeah, I mean, not around Tulsa, but
right.
when you go further west, yes,
right.
it's right up there with prairie dogs.
And it's dangerous to have around any structures because of the fire hazard.
Yeah.
But because there's no more fire on the prairie, the fires that we do have tend to burn hotter, so they become more dangerous. So there's a lot of issues tied up in just this one material, which is why I chose to use it for this project. It's titled Memory Ring, and the reason is because the slices of the memory of the tree, you know, they're used to date human events because they have that memory.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to the results at 108 Contemporary. Heather, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
It's great talking with you. Thank you.
Oklahoma fiber artist Heather Clark Hilliard speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is the inaugural artist in residence for 108 Contemporary, and her exhibit is titled Finding the Fire, Concepts in Fiber Arts. It will be on display through July 20th at 108 Contemporary, located at 108 East Brady. More information at 108contemporary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.